Bruce guessed him to be between the ages of 40 and 60, with at least a college education. But it wasn't her job to make such inferences, at least not in this case. With the same pen and paper as Ricky, she wrote a nice little note to Al. The text had been prepared by someone else. She did not know who, nor did she care. It was, "Hey, Al, where have you been? Why haven't you written? Don't forget about me." That kind of letter, but with a nice little surprise. Since Ricky couldn't use the phone, he was sending Al a cassette tape with a brief message from deep inside rehab. Bruce fit the letter onto one page, then worked for an hour on the envelope. The postmark she applied was from Neptune Beach, Florida. She didn't seal the envelope. Her little project was inspected, then taken to another lab. The tape was recorded by a young agent who'd studied drama at Northwestern. In a soft, accentless voice, he said, "Hey, Al, this is Ricky. Hope you're surprised to hear my voice. They won't let us use the phones around here. I don't know why, but for some reason we can send tapes back and forth. I can't wait to get out of this place." Then he rambled for 5 minutes about his rehab and how much he hated his uncle and the people who ran Aladdin North. But he did concede that they had rid him of his addictions. He was certain he would look back and not judge the place too harshly. His entire narrative was nothing but babble. No plans were discussed for his release, no hint of where he might go or what he might do, only a vague reference about seeing Al one day. They were not yet ready to bait Al Conyers. The sole purpose of the tape was to hide within its casing a transmitter strong enough to lead them to Lake's hidden file. A tiny bug in the envelope was too risky. Al might be smart enough to find it. At Mailbox America in Chevy Chase, the CIA now controlled 8 boxes, duly rented for 1 year by 8 different people, each of whom had the same 24-hour access that Mr. Conyers had. They came and went at all hours, checking their little boxes, picking up mail they'd sent themselves, occasionally taking a peek at Al's box if no one was looking. Since they knew his schedule better than he knew it himself, they waited patiently until he'd made his rounds. They felt certain he'd sneak out as before, dressed like a jogger. So they held the envelope with the tape until almost 10 one night. Then they placed it in his box. 4 hours later, with a dozen agents watching every move, Lake the jogger jumped from a cab in front of Mailbox America, darted inside, his face hidden by the long bill of a running cap, went to his box, pulled out the mail, and hurried back into the cab. 6 hours later, he left Georgetown for a prayer breakfast at the Hilton, and they waited. He addressed an association of police chiefs at 9 and 1,000 high school principals at 11. He lunched with the Speaker of the House. He taped a stressful Q&A session with some talking heads at 3, then returned home to pack. His itinerary called for him to depart Reagan National at 8 and fly to Dallas. They followed him to the airport, watched the Boeing 707 take off, then called Langley. When the 2 Secret Service agents arrived to check the perimeter of Lake's townhouse, the CIA was already inside. The search ended in the kitchen 10 minutes after it began. A handheld receptor caught the signal from the cassette tape. They found it in the wastebasket, along with an empty half-gallon milk jug, 2 torn packages of oatmeal, some soiled paper towels, and that morning's edition of the Washington Post. A maid came twice a week. Lake had simply left the garbage for her to take care of. They couldn't find Lake's file because he didn't have one. Smart man, he'd tossed away the evidence. Teddy was almost relieved when he got word. The team was still in the townhouse, hiding and waiting for the Secret Service to leave. Whatever Lake did in his secret life, he worked hard not to leave a trail. The tape unnerved Aaron Lake. Reading Ricky's letters and looking at his handsome face had given him a nervous thrill. The young man was far away, and odds were they'd never meet. They could be pen pals and play tag at a distance, and move slowly, at least that's what Lake had contemplated initially. But hearing Ricky's voice had brought him much closer, and Lake was rattled. What had begun a few months earlier as a curious little game now held horrible possibilities. It was much too risky. Blake trembled at the thought of getting caught. It still seemed impossible, though. He was well hidden behind the mask of Al Conyers. Ricky had not a clue. It was Al this and Al that on the tape. The post office box was his shield. But he had to end it, at least for now. The Boeing was packed with Lake's well-paid people. They didn't make an airplane big enough to haul his entire entourage. If he leased a 747, within 2 days it would be filled with CAs and advisors and consultants and pollsters, not to mention his own growing army of bodyguards from the Secret Service. The more primaries he won, the heavier his plane became. It might be wise to lose a couple of states so he could jettison some of the baggage. In the darkness of the plane, Lake sipped tomato juice and decided to write a final letter to Ricky. Al would wish him the best and simply terminate the correspondence. What could the boy do? He was tempted to write the note right then, sitting in his deep recliner, his feet in the air. But at any moment, an assistant of some variety would emerge with another breathless report that the candidate had to hear immediately. He had no privacy. He had no time to think or loaf or daydream. Every pleasant thought was interrupted by a new poll, or a late-breaking story, or an urgent need to make a decision. Surely he'd be able to hide in the White House. Loners had lived there before.